Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's episode, we take a whirlwind trip around the world before returning home to London as we look back at some of our favourite tall stories from 2019. From a particularly unique train line in Japan.
The train was canary yellow and covered in enormous pink and orange flowers. With no information available in English, I figured this could only be the flower line.
To a rather suggestive piece of fascist architecture in Italy.
Once Italy's fascist days were over, the Turinese, forever polite, started calling it Mussolini's finger.
We stop off in all corners of the globe to relive some of the best stories from the year that was. So stay with us over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist, with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, why don't we start in a slightly sunnier spot than London and head to the beaches of Rio de Janeiro. The Copacabana Palace is an icon of Brazilian glamour and sophistication, and this Art Deco masterpiece holds the same charm today as it did when it opened its doors in 1923. Back in February, Monocle 24's very own Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, dressed to the nines and delved into the history of the hotel. Let's have a listen. At the Copacabana,
the hottest spot north of Havana. An icon of Brazilian glamour, the Copacabana Palace opened its doors in 1923 and remains intrinsically connected to Rio's fun party scene, hosting legendary carnival parties. The hotel was even the backdrop of a 1933 Hollywood musical featuring Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and illustrious guests have ranged from Marilyn Monroe to Bill Clinton. Every time I return to my homeland, I make sure to visit Rio. Sometimes I stay with friends or in hotels, but shockingly never stayed at the famous Copa, as locals like to call it. Well, not anymore. On my recent trip to Brazil, I decided to stay there for 2 nights with my partner to understand the myth behind, and I wasn't disappointed. In recent years, Rio welcomed a great selection of fantastic hotels. Recent openings include Arpoador Inn, Emiliano, Janeiro Hotel, among others. But I don't think the Copa is very worried. The Art Deco Hotel has recently been revamped. Overall, there are 239 rooms and all the furniture is made from Brazilian teak and mahogany wood. I find the rooms were elegant and roomy, but one thing that really impressed me was the amazing customer service and overall friendliness of the staff. It makes it for a special experience. Even in the busy summer season, they were not bothered by my very early check-in, for example. And in all the rooms of the hotel, you can smell a whiff of lemongrass. Apparently, you can buy the product in their spa. The pool of the hotel is glorious. Drinking a caipirinha while listening to many birds chirping at the hotel is priceless. Be early though, there is a Germanic attitude when it comes to grabbing a nice lounger by the pool. The breakfast was very special, with all the fruits you can imagine, plus Brazilian favorites such as pão de queijo, which is some sort of cheesy bread, and other options of bread. Brazilians adore bread, and so do I. I'm so glad we're not yet a granola or avocado toast nation. Although Ipanema offers an overall cooler and sexier vibe than Copacabana, it's worth staying at the latter only because of this magnificent hotel. I'll be very happy having all my meals at the beautiful room with a painted wall of palm trees and tropical birds and gentle bossa nova playing in the background.
Our thanks to Fernando Augusto Pacheco for that rather glamorous trip to Brazil. To the USA next, we were lucky enough to have the Urbanist producer, Carlotta Rabello, stationed in our Los Angeles bureau for a large chunk of 2019, which meant that we were graced with an even more fantastic reportage out of America than usual. I don't believe she wrote this script. Back in April, Carlotta took us to the steel powerhouse of Pittsburgh, which happens to be the proud home of 446 bridges. Let's listen in.
When I first shared with friends that I'd be visiting Pittsburgh, almost every single one of them mentioned how I wouldn't be able to miss the Yellow Bridges. At first, I thought they meant such an iconic landmark that I simply had to see it. Or perhaps this was right on the city center and there was no way to escape it. But after a handful of hours in downtown Pittsburgh, it became evident. This simply is a city with bridges at every turn. 446 of them, to be precise. But this is not a case of engineering gone mad. The city is laid on a series of valleys, hilltops and mountains with three major rivers running through it. Without the bridges, we wouldn't have a city at all, but just a series of fragmented little towns with no real connection between them. This terrain posed a major challenge for the first settlers that arrived to the region, and building small wooden bridges became the easy solution to navigate from hilltop to valley and so forth. The first proper river bridge was built in 1818 at Smithfield Street. Originally made out of wood, it was destroyed in the city's Great Fire of 1845 and eventually replaced by a wire rope suspension bridge, a work by John Roebling, the creator of the famous Brooklyn Bridge. Over time and usage, this became one of the most popular thoroughfares in the city, meaning that it needed once more to be upgraded. Eventually, it was closed down and replaced with a steel structure we still see today, meaning that the Smithfield Street Bridge is Pittsburgh's oldest in service crossing, and in fact, the oldest bridge still in operation in the United States. The decades between 1920 and 1940 saw a boom in construction in Pittsburgh, specifically when it came to road and bridge building. Most of the major bridges in the city that still stand today date back to this period, mostly built from locally produced steel. What's interesting as well is that when you look at a city that has this long history of bridge building, you end up with an almost perfect portfolio, meaning that you can find almost any type of bridge construction right here. From cable suspension resembling the Art Deco movement to cast iron structures or arched and double-decker bridges. There's the industry side to all of this as well. Maintaining all these structures is an expensive business for the city. It's estimated that $150 million is invested each year in the bridge's upkeep. Through the centuries, they have been crucial in creating jobs in the region, especially after the steel industry entered into decline. However, there's yet another unifying factor when it comes to Pittsburgh's many bridges. Most of them are painted in yellow. Well, not yellow, but Aztec gold, as locals will promptly correct you. There's no consensus on where the decision to use this color came from, but seeing that black and gold are the official colors of Pittsburgh, it does fit with the narrative. The city officially embraced those colors in 1989, taken from the coat of arms of William Pitt. Locals do take their bridges very seriously. A couple of years ago, a handful of the downtown area bridges were up for maintenance, and the city's History and Landmarks Foundation suggested that this was perhaps a good opportunity to introduce new paint schemes and shake up the traditional color scheme. It's safe to say this wasn't exactly received with open arms, and the plan went nowhere. For now, the yellow / Aztec gold bridges are here to stay.
A very wonderful producer, Carlotta Ribello there, reporting from Pittsburgh. Just a hop across the Pacific now as we head to New Zealand. Summer is in full swing in that part of the world right now, but back in July, when the Kiwi weather wasn't so glowing, the Urbanist co-producer, David Stevens, took us to his old family batch to ponder if this important facet of the holiday season might be fading. Here he is.
If you can't see the beach, you can definitely feel it. It's in the air, so heavy with salt you can taste it on your lips, or in the sound of crashing waves from behind the tree line. Besides, everything is swept with sand. The back garden collects deposits when the wind whips up enough, so does the spot by the door where you take off your shoes after an evening running through the dunes. The kiwi batch breathes in and out with the tides. A New Zealander is never really far from the ocean. The farthest point in the country is still less than 120 kilometres from the shore, and Kiwis who move off the island somehow end up even closer to the water, holding it somewhere in the pit of their stomach or the base of their spine. My family batch, or the beach house as we called it, still has memories living inside it even long after it was sold. It has my first jellyfish sting and my worst ever splinter. Someone really should have sanded that deck. It's got dance parties in the living room with my granddad and staying up late to see in the year 2000 on TV. I only made it to 10 p.m. Many Kiwis hold similar hazy, pieced-together memories of their own holiday homes, and while the numbers may read differently on the novelty beach-themed letterbox, the sentiment remains the same. The holiday home is in our DNA. But where did this particular holiday trope come from?
New Zealanders want to see the result of victory in order and progress, in a better standard of living for every New Zealander. They want homes. For a home is the basis of the simple things that made victory worthwhile, the things that men gave their lives for.
Post-World War II, the country experienced a building boom. The 50s also brought about road improvements, better connecting the small sand-swept towns of the coast to the city. It was the perfect recipe for this particular brand of middle-class holidaymaking to take hold in the country. The properties were passed down through generations, while the collection of Tom Jones records grew and the puzzle pieces seemed to vanish. And it's not uncommon for generations of memories to all reside within the same four walls. But tides go out, bubbles burst, and the country now faces a housing shortage. The average Kiwi can hardly defend owning a house that's only lived in 3 weeks out of the year. The newest generation of family-making New Zealanders are having to consider a life lived without even owning one home, let alone two. So what can you do? Well, you could book a beachside Airbnb, but the result is all a bit too clinical. That's not your collection of driftwood assembled on the windowsill. You don't know the six of clubs is missing from that pack of cards, or how to get the hot water in the shower just right after a chilly dip in the Pacific. Besides, you want to get to know your occasional neighbours just as well as your city ones. You need a Mr. Henare to throw your cricket ball back when your uncle hits another six over the fence, or a Mrs. Bradley to water your front garden when the flower beds are looking particularly parched. Without them, the place is just a bit quiet. It's unclear if the prospect of owning a holiday home will return anytime soon for a generation of property-challenged 20-somethings, or if the holiday home industry will win out and turn this element of our national identity into a series of soulless coastal motels. But perhaps what we can do is take part in a bit of urban rebellion to bring a sense of beach house living to our own apartments or flats. Let's embrace the temperamental stovetops and incomplete puzzles, and let's bring a little bit of the batch back home.
Our thanks to David Stevens for that walk down memory lane. We're off to Japan next. Stay tuned. Let's get across to Japan, where we took a ride on a particularly quirky train line in the Yamagata Prefecture. To mark our Japan-centric December-January issue of Monocle, we sent our very own Holly Fisher for a ride on the eye-catching Flower Nagai line for a commute with a difference. Let's climb on board.
Recently, I went to Tokyo for the first time. It was a work trip, and as part of it, I was required to leave the safety net of the big international capital city and venture into pastures very much unknown, in the form of a much, much smaller city called Nagai in Yamagata Prefecture. Oh, wow. I've heard it's really nice. It's known for its beef. No, I've never actually been to Yamagata, was the general consensus from all the locals I spoke to in Tokyo. In fact, I didn't meet a single person who'd ever been to Yamagata. I spent a long time in line at Shibuya Station trying to buy a ticket to get to Nagai, to be told that I could only purchase half my trip. The journey consisted of two trains, and the second line, called the Flower Nagai Line, wasn't sellable in Tokyo. Used to a much more united train service in the UK, I found this strange and a bit frustrating, but got my ticket to the halfway point, Akayu, and figured I would sort out the rest of the journey from there. And so departure day arrived. After whizzing through Japanese cities on the very efficient Shinkansen, I pulled into Akayu Station, where I headed straight to the ticket office and was met by a man behind the desk. "Nagai?" I asked. "Four," he replied cryptically. "Ticket?" I tried. "Train," he responded. He pointed to empty platform 4, which had a small waiting room on it, and so I headed over, ticketless and a little confused. After a few minutes, a rickety single carriage turned up, and it was a sight to behold. The train was canary yellow and covered in enormous pink and orange flowers. With no information available in English, I figured this could only be the Flower Line, and so I boarded. Inside felt like a Wes Anderson time machine. Two pale pink cushioned benches lined either side of the grey symmetrical carriage, and the driver wore a vivid electric blue uniform. This was a million miles away from the bullet train I'd just alighted from. I took a seat near the driver to try and suss out what I was doing. It seemed that at each station a price would flash up on the board, and as you exited the train you had to put some money in a box. "Okay, I've got this," I thought. But then, to further my foreignness, the train suddenly filled with about 40 very small Japanese schoolchildren. They can't have been more than 5 years old, and they all wore matching yellow hats that strapped under the chin. As they took their seats, they clocked the tall blonde woman sitting near the driver's compartment. 40 pairs of eyes fell on me as the kids whispered and pointed and giggled. Then, out of nowhere, "Hello." I looked up. A young boy was looking sheepishly at me. I replied, "Hello." The children all shrieked with excitement, and before I knew it, I was being bombarded. "Hello, hello, 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 hello." The unease of being the centre of attention on this tiny vehicle was soon lit up by the warmth of these very sweet children towards me, the stranger on board. And once I'd greeted each of them, we all settled into the lurching rhythm of the chugging train, and they left me to enjoy the mountainous backdrop to this rural part of Japan. I've been told that Japan is currently looking at other countries' railway models to see how they can make the entirety of their train systems easier to use. I certainly would have appreciated that when I was nervously planning my trip from Shibuya Station. But in hindsight, the uncertainties and oddities of that little floral train and its passengers are what will stay with me forever.
Our thanks to Holly Fisher there, reporting from Japan. Next stop, well, it's Italy, where back in June, Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Ramella, took us to our home city of Turin to ponder a towering relic of the country's fascist past. Referred to as Mussolini's Finger, the Torre Littoria has stayed standing despite calls from residents to have the building removed. Here's Chiara to tell us more.
Skyscrapers are metaphorical things. Put a Freudian hat on and it will become pretty obvious that the upward thrust of modernity is proudly virile. It's not surprising then that Italy's fascist dictator Benito Mussolini did like towers. Il Duce liked standing legs akimbo, hands on his hips. He swam through straits and seas. He worked shirtless in the fields. He was, in his eyes and those of the people, a manly man of action. Before him, nobody had brought the new buildings in the style of Chicago to Italy. But come the 1930s, his well-established regime was moulding a country in its own image. Buildings became propaganda, their aesthetics an almost impossible marriage between the clean lines of ancient Roman architecture and the futurism of modernity. Skyscrapers couldn't miss from Mussolini's arsenal. It may not have been the first fascist tower in Italy, nor the country's most famous, but Turin's Torre Littoria is almost too obvious an example of fascism's ability to make an architectural point. Turin is an elegant, genteel city, all sober 18th century palazzos and Baroque churches. It is homogeneous, red-roofed, remarkably low-rise. It is here that the monarchic family, the Savoia, started building their countrywide reign, but the city's position up in the northwest of the country meant it couldn't function as the capital of unified Italy for long. By 1865, the official administrative seat was moved to Florence and later to Rome. Yet Turin and its royal palaces remained inextricably linked to the monarchs. The Torre Littoria was originally planned to rise elsewhere, further away from the centre of the city, but as the central Via Roma was being redeveloped to become the city's commercial artery, it was decided the new tower should be built at the road's end, on Piazza Castello. Smack bang in the centre of town and very non-incidentally, right in front of Palazzo Reale. The royal family's former residence sat, low-slung and magnificent, just on the other side of the square. The project for the Torre Littoria was drawn up in 1933 by Armando Melis de Villa and Giovanni Bernocco. The tall, stridently straight structure, topped by a turret and a spire, was drawn to reach 87 metres and watched the royal palace comfortably from above. Rumours abound it was originally built to host the headquarters of the fascist party. Eventually, the structure got bought out to become the offices of Reale Mutua, Turin's most powerful insurers. In the 1930s, Mussolini was the country's leader Maximus in a country that remained, after all, a monarchy. The king might not have had much actual power, but his presence was still conspicuous. In a typical fascist display of tireless strength and bravado, works to build the tower went on night and day, and the tower was completed in an impressively short amount of time. By 1934, it made its aggressive entrance on the elegant square. Its red bricks, square windows, and, well, the absolute disproportionate size of it made it quite noticeably stand out. Enthusiastic residents and businesses, though, were keen to move into this very innovative structure. Not only was this the first building in Italy to feature a welded metal frame, but the materials inside the flats, glass brick, clinker brick, and linoleum, were all the stuff of the future. At first, the tower earned itself the title of highest apartment building in Italy, and come the 40s, it housed the city centre's anti-bombing siren. But soon enough, it started getting nicknames too. The Turinese, forever polite, started calling it Mussolini's finger. But not only that, the Torre Littoria became known as the Arrogant Tower, or rather more straightforwardly, the Eyesore. There are those who recognise and appreciate the value of fascist-era architecture, its austere lines, its strict angles, its showy monumentality. Others dislike it. They hate its aesthetics, and mainly the ideology they so blatantly represent. In Turin, like elsewhere in Italy, people have wished the Torre Littoria away. Its incongruous presence is a perennial, uncomfortable reminder of a violent rip in a city's history. If the Arrogant Tower failed to merge with the city's fabric after all, it's also because attempts to open a cafe, a restaurant, or even just a panoramic elevator inside the tower have all failed. The Torre Littoria has remained closed off to everybody bar the few who inhabit it. It's an awkward leftover of a time that many would rather forget, but that cannot be erased from memory. And so the finger stands, sticking out, impenetrable and brazen, right in our faces.
That was Chiara Ramella giving us the finger there from Turin. Next, I come face to face with a ghost. Stay tuned. Do you see ghosts? I don't mean spectral beings emerging from your bedroom wall or strange figures in the mist. I mean ghosts of your times past, echoes of lives that you lived. Let me explain. I've lived in London a long time. I came here to go to university and have stayed and stayed. And across decades, my life has played out in streets, restaurants, bars, and offices that form but a fraction of this vast metropolis. Most days you dart around the city, simply focused on getting to where you need to be. But every now and then, you see a ghost. Often, the ghost is you. Last weekend, I was in London's Covent Garden and walked past the office where I got my first go at trying to be a journalist. And I momentarily caught a flash of myself walking up the stairs, armed with a lot of hope, but perhaps not much else. It was here that I met Tony Elliott, the founder of Time Out, who, for a reason I've never quite fathomed, decided to give this intern a chance. At the end of the same road, I walked past what was the greengrocer's, but now offers desirable bottles of wine. And just around the corner, I saw where my friend had a PR company. I can't quite walk past that door without thinking about the injustice of those early years of AIDS. Ghosts to the right and to the left of me. But these are not visions to be scared of. They are memories etched into place. Even when those places have been changed by time and commerce. They are places that remind me of trips to London as a kid with my parents, of when I first came here to study, of long nights out in clubs, of triumphs and failures, dates and breakups. There are places that can trigger a smile and others that are perhaps best forgot. But apart from all the urban lures of work and play that normally bind us to a city, in the end, it's often ghosts that make us feel like a city really belongs to us, and perhaps us to it. Well, that's it for this special edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And guess what? David edited the show too. And to play you out of this week's episode, well, here's Matt Maltese with Tall Buildings. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Breathe with me.